Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
For all you economically troubled young people out there, the ultimate plan B. Hit it, Jerry.
No way that moving in with your parents is a sign that your life is right on track. There's no way that you could fake this even. Yeah, things are going great. I met a terrific girl. I got a great job making a lot of money. And if everything goes according to plan, I'm going to be moving back in with my parents soon.
The parental bailout, is it a gigantic tax on mom and dad? Rules of the road for those prodigal sons and daughters, the things that wouldn't leave. A show about nothing? Not here at The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, May 15th. I'm John Huckenberry, and Twas Zwillig and the Slithy Toes did gyre and gimble in the wave. Todd Zwillig is here with me.
If I can rhyme Hockenberry with something by the end of the hour, I'll
impossible,
do it.
Impossible, dude.
I'll give it a shot. Good morning, John. Coming up this hour, we discuss Nancy Pelosi's remarks yesterday. She says she knew about the CIA's use of waterboarding in 2003, and there's plenty of controversy surrounding the president's commencement address at Notre Dame on Sunday. We check in with a junior at the school to hear how the debate is playing out among students. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
And in the headlines, President Obama is expected to announce today that he's reviving and revising military tribunals for a small number of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Christine Husky, a lawyer for two of the detainees, says the president is going back on his word.
Obama campaigned sort of under the promise and on the platform that the military commissions were terrible and that's not what the Bush administration should have done. So I think just from a purely political perspective, he's kind of breaking a promise.
President Obama criticized the tribunals under the Bush administration, but he is expected to change the system under this new plan with new legal safeguards for detainees. Overseas, the Pakistani military is lifting the curfew in much of the northwest Swat Valley to make it easier for civilians to evade fighting between the army and Taliban militants. The UN is calling for a massive emergency injection of aid to improve conditions in the refugee camp housing many of the displaced civilians around the country. Todd?
In Israel, Pope Benedict has strongly condemned the Holocaust as a, quote, brutal extermination of Jews by a godless Nazi regime, end quote. The remarks come as the Pope prepared to leave the country after his eight-day tour of the Middle East. During the trip, he faced criticism that he'd failed to sufficiently apologize for Nazi atrocities. The Pope previously belonged to the Hitler Youth in his native Germany. North Korea says that all contracts for the joint industrial complex it shares with South Korea are now invalid. The North is planning to draw up its own regulations on wages and taxes. It says the South Korean companies must accept the new regulations or leave the complex, which lies on the border. Six major insurers have received preliminary approval to get billions of dollars from the TARP bailout fund. It's the end of a months-long quest by some in the sector for financial assistance.
Banks, insurance companies, restaurants are next. In Europe, the economies of the 16 nations that use the euro declined by 2.5% in the first quarter of 2009. The Dow rose 0.6% yesterday to close at 83.31. The S&P went up 1% to finish at 8.93. We're going to learn the consumer price index from last month later on this morning. And we're talking about the 40-year war on drugs. Change the name, will you? It's the blank on drugs. If decriminalization or legalization is something you support, what would you legalize? And if you're opposed, send us your view at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. This is John Huckenberry. Joining us in just a moment, Philip Gurevich, the writer, is going to talk about the difficulty in this decision, whether or not to release photos that show abuse of detainees at Guantanamo, additional photos. Also, Scott Shane of the New York Times is going to talk about how an administration has a whole range of tools to suppress information. But I'm here with Todd Zwillig, and I wanted you to help me out here, Todd.
Yeah.
It seems that in the early part of the administration, the main issue, and it's kind of a surprise to me, that's developing is this issue over who knew what when as far as detainees are concerned and how to deal with the issues of justice involving detainees who were taken under the Bush administration. Are you getting that impression?
I am. It kind of started off almost as a sideshow with Republican leaders in the House criticizing Nancy Pelosi. Well, you used to be on the Intelligence Committee. What did you know and when did you know it? And it was sort of a partisan sideshow, kind of seemed to be trying to draw the Democratic leader, the Speaker of the House, into a broader discussion.
Well, we've got a headline on Pelosi as of yesterday, and also the fact that the administration wants to do these military tribunals, which we thought were suspended indefinitely. There are going to be 20 tribunals in Guantanamo. Let's listen to Nancy Pelosi yesterday addressing the issue of when she was briefed and what she knew at a news conference just yesterday.
Madam Speaker, just to be clear, you're accusing the CIA of lying to you in September of 2002.
Misleading the Congress of the United States.
And doing it again now as they've released this this list of briefings that says you were briefed on the interrogation tactics that were used.
I'm quoting what the head of the CIA has said. This is we don't know if this information is accurate that he's talking about.
Well, that's Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, speaking yesterday. It's not a sideshow anymore, Todd.
It's not. This whole thing has grown from what started out as a sideshow into a much broader issue now, which is a confrontation between not only the executive and the Congress, but what is Congress going to do about oversight and looking back? The president has made it very clear. He's not interested in any kind of truth commission. He's not interested in looking back. I want to look forward. Really, what he's saying is, I don't want to get bogged down in turning the pages on the Bush administration. I have a big domestic agenda, and I don't want to spend my energy, more importantly, my political capital on it. Well, Nancy Pelosi disagreed with that. So did Chairman Patrick Leahy of the Judiciary Committee. I can't tell you what's inside of her head, but I do know that she's smart enough to know exactly what she's doing when she accuses the CIA of lying. Now it's a much broader issue than just a fight between Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner.
But I'm wondering if Nancy Pelosi here is a little bit overmatched. Here she is saying that, okay, waterboarding came up in that early briefing I was in, but nobody said it was being employed. And she sounds a little rattled here.
The only mention of waterboarding was that in the briefing was that it was not being employed. When my staff person, I'm sorry, I had the pages out of order here. 5 months later, my staff person told me that there had been a briefing, informed me that there had been a briefing and that a letter had been sent.
Now there's Pelosi sort of fumbling for pages, but John Boehner, the Republican representative on the other side, minutes later had this kind of locked and loaded response.
It's hard for me to imagine that anyone in our intelligence area would ever mislead a member of Congress.
Todd, how does this battle between two House members who are actually impaneled to fight each other on almost every issue,
right.
This is what they do, how does it become a broader issue of maybe Congress versus the executive?
Well, because those issues have been brewing ever since – well, they've been brewing forever in the history of the Republic. But in our case, they've been brewing since the war on terror began, ever since President Bush took much stronger executive power in executing the war on terror. Barack Obama's the new president. He's spoken out against some of those power grabs. He certainly spoke out against them as a senator. But now that he's commander-in-chief, he hasn't necessarily relinquished all of those. President Obama has signing statements that Congress denounces because it detracts from their power. The president has said he's not going to release photos that members of Congress want to see or think the public should see. The president has said he's going to restart military tribunals for some detainees.
Right.
So he's now commander-in-chief, and a lot of people are thinking, well, this is classic. This is what happens when a candidate turns into commander-in-chief and has to confront all of the issues of being commander-in-chief. But the broader issue, yes, is the classic tension between Congress and the presidency and what the speaker may have done by going directly at the CIA, not only shifting the focus away from herself, but bringing this issue of some kind of truth commission, some kind of way of getting all of this out. She's wanted that all along. I can't tell you if that's her strategy, but she's certainly bringing that argument back up to the fore that we need a broader effort here to uncover what happened in the Bush administration.
Well, Pelosi is kind of the pretext. The issues in the Bush administration are sort of the overall policy question. Is there consensus among the Democrats of actually opening the Cheney box box and seeing everything that's inside?
I don't think that there is, and a lot of Democrats are leaving it alone. There's certainly consensus on the left, on Barack Obama's left, which is where Nancy Pelosi sits and her constituency sits. Incidentally, it's where Patrick Leahy sits as well, and those are two powerful people on this. Dianne Feinstein, Democratic California, does not sit there. She's much more moderate, so those tensions are playing out on the Democratic side.
Well, let's leave it there. My favorite bit of this, though, and we don't have to talk about it now, is the fact that you've got Nancy Pelosi from the Bay Area, you've got Dianne Feinstein, former mayor of San Francisco on the Senate side, and Leon Panetta, the head of the CIA from Monterey, California. There's got to be some backstory there. Let's leave that.
But all playing out in San Francisco. Well, for the moment, let's move on to the issue of the torture photos and the president's decision that he doesn't want to release the photos of detainee abuse similar to the ones that we saw at Abu Ghraib. We've got Scott Shane on the line. Scott is a reporter for our partners, the New York Times, and he has a story in today's paper about what the president may need to do legally to keep the photos out of the hands and away from the eyes of the public, which he says he wants to do. Scott, what legal options does the president have to keep us from seeing those photos?
Well, the Bush administration fought the release of these photos for years, really. This is a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that was initially filed in 2003. And they lost first at the district court level and then at the appeals court level on the grounds of invasion of privacy of both the detainees and the people who were allegedly abusing them. They lost on another count. They said that this there's a sort of a public safety exception to the Freedom of Information Act. They lost on that. And so there was an agreement that these photos would be released. President Obama, under pressure from the military, reversed course and decided he would try to fight it.
Right.
And
everybody's filing Freedom of Information requests now, everyone from the ACLU to Dick Cheney himself.
And some of that's with the encouragement of President Obama, who began his administration by talking about transparency and urging agencies to be willing to release documents if they were sort of on the borderline. But most of the experts I talked to yesterday said that his best option is probably to classify these photos, which are not now classified, say that they have, for national security implications, are classified and sort of refight the battle if the courts allow him to do that.
And is he likely to do that, to classify them and once again go down the same road or a similar road that the Bush administration went down? They were criticized over and over again for claiming executive privilege or classifying things that the public wanted to see or the ACLU wanted to see. He'll be vulnerable to that kind of criticism once again, won't he?
Well, certainly the American Civil Liberties Union, which has been trying to seek these photos, has already said that this is a violation of his pledge of transparency. There is a way in which, however, it's quite consistent with what he said, because on the campaign and since becoming president, he has criticized harsh interrogations under the Bush administration, saying they made the country less safe because they were a recruiting tactic for al-Qaeda. Now he's saying that if you put these photos up on the web, they will also be a recruiting tactic for al-Qaeda, and he says they mostly come, and I believe this is correct, from closed criminal cases, and so he's suggesting that they're inflammatory but don't contain a lot of new information.
Scott, isn't there an inherent conflict between Obama's mission to improve America's image in the world and this question of transparency here at home?
Absolutely, and he has again and again shown a reluctance to delve into the dark side, as former Vice President Cheney called it, of the Bush administration's campaign against terrorism. He doesn't want a truth commission. He doesn't want to spend his political capital fighting the Republicans on issues like this. He wants to move on to health care and so on, but it just keeps coming back.
And Scott, just to be clear real quickly, is classifying these photos a fail-safe for the president if he does? A lot of people saying, well, this whole argument is kind of moot because these will leak out into the public anyway if the second, you know, regardless of how the Second Circuit rules, you know, they'll leak out anyway. Is classification a fail-safe for the White House?
Well, I think a lot of people think that the government may ultimately lose the case and the courts may order them to release the photos.
Yeah.
But in that case, President Obama has taken a bullet for the military, so to speak. He's sided with them in something they feel very strongly about.
That was Scott Shane, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. He joined us to talk about the president's options for keeping abuse photos out of the hands of the public. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
You got photos there. You've got the tribunals. You've got all these battles on Capitol Hill about briefings. It's a rich brew.
Yes. Yes, it is. And the issue of intelligence and detainee treatment, which some hoped would die with the last administration, John.
It's not going to happen.
Nope.
Not going to happen.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting here with John Hockenberry. I'm still trying to think up a rhyme for Hockenberry. I'm not there yet. I'm getting close. Something that rhymes with it. Well, there's a foreseeable end. We might be ending the end, the 40-year war on drugs. To find out more, you can go to our website to find out how the war on drugs.
Sound like you're on drugs.
Well,
let's focus here.
Caffeine qualifies. That's true.
Let's focus here.
Well, we want to get your take. You're probably more focused than I am on this issue. What do we do with drugs in America? Maybe we need a new phrase. The what on drugs? What would you call it? Casey from Draper, Utah, emails us and says, judging from the current prison statistics on drug convictions, it's more like the war on America. Who benefits? Certainly not the taxpayers.
That's a good one.
Yeah, well, call us with your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So during a political campaign, abortion, as we all know, is a hot-button political issue. But once the president gets into office, it could be quite a different story. Barack Obama has already signaled that a strident abortion debate is not to be a feature of his administration.
The Freedom of Choice Act is not my highest legislative priority. I believe that women should have the right to choose. But I think that the most important thing we can do to tamp down some of the anger surrounding this issue is to focus on those areas that we can agree on. And that's where I'm going to focus.
And that perhaps is the mission of Barack Obama speaking at the commencement address at the University of Notre Dame this weekend. Tamping down the anger is something that perhaps will be a feature of his speech, but it's a controversy to have a freedom of choice president or a pro-choice president speak at a Catholic university. We decided to see if anger was an issue that concerned the students at Notre Dame who are arguing over this and are witnessing the president coming this weekend. Aaron Steiner joins us. He's a junior at Notre Dame, majoring in business and German. He's the assistant managing editor of the school's paper, The Observer. Aaron, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, John.
My first question is, do the students think it's a good idea to reduce the level of anger, even as this is a controversy, having Barack Obama speak this weekend?
You know, I think you hit the nail on the head that this has generated controversy, you're right, but I think that it's important to note that the controversy really is coming from outside the university's borders. And I think that most students do want to kind of tamp down, as you say, the level of anger. A sort of a radical approach that so many people take to this this issue.
And how does that manifest itself? I mean, what conversations have you heard?
Right. I think on campus we've seen a lot of students. Of course, this is an issue that every student is talking about. This has been, you know, the issue people talk about in their dorms, in the dining halls, and in classrooms for the past almost 2 months now since the announcement was made in March. And people recognize the symbolic nature of this issue, and obviously it's generated a lot of national attention.
Now,
at the same time, the discussions that students are having, I think, are much different than what we see outside, as I said, the university's borders. Students are, I think, approaching this in a much more thoughtful, considerate way, and they're examining, I think, both sides of the issues, and they recognize the complexity of this issue.
Now, Barack Obama wouldn't be the first pro-choice politician to visit the campus, to speak there, to get an award there. How does that play into the debate?
Right. I think, you know, there's a couple of things that play into that. As you mentioned, we've had other pro-choice commencement speakers even in the past. I think this time around, there are a few things that are contributing to this being such a hot button issue. Of course, President Obama has moved rather quickly in his first 100 days in office with his pro-choice politics. And, of course, that's upset, you know, many in the pro-life movement. I think the reason that this has generated so much attention is that this is one of the real first opportunities for those in the pro-life movement to kind of put forward their agenda, to kind of find a focal point for activity. So we've seen as soon as, you know, within the first week of the announcement, we had one activist move to South Bend and announce he's launching an on-the-ground campaign to, you know, combat the university's, you know, treacherous decision, as he said, and then also to create a political mud pit, as he said, around the president, you know, to hurt his chances with Catholic voters in the future and to, of course, advance the pro-life cause. So this has really become a flashpoint for their agenda in the past weeks.
What do students think about that? I mean, turning the campus into this showplace for what could end up in, you know, political campaign commercials 4 years from now.
Right, exactly. I think, as I said, people recognize that, you know, this is a symbolic event for a lot of American Catholics and a lot of Americans nationwide who have strong feelings about the abortion issue. But at the same time, the graduates have expressed some concern that, as you said, their graduation is be turning into, you know, kind of a political circus, you know, at the expense of, you know, all their families and everyone that's coming in. They're going to be, you know, watching pictures of aborted fetuses either fly over our campus. We've had a plane circle our campus now for almost a month. Or, you know, pictures of aborted fetuses lining the streets around campus. So I think that they're definitely upset about it, but at the same time, I think they're tempering that with, you know, the knowledge that this is something very important for a lot of people across the country.
Finally, Aaron, is there a tradition in Jesuit sort of Catholic thought of tolerance and intellectual inquiry on an issue as controversial as abortion, or is this just kind of doctrinal and dogmatic? And how would a student at Notre Dame make that argument to someone on the outside?
Well, I think that's precisely the tension between this, you know, dogmatic, you know, orthodoxical approach that some people take, and then the more free-thinking, you know, we talk about academic freedom and, you know, examination of all sides that, you know, a lot of people argue should be, you know, the way a university operates. And students are talking about that. How much can we you know, examine these issues from all sides, but while still maintaining our Catholic background, our Catholic roots, and being true in some cases to Catholic orthodoxy, being that we are a Catholic university. So this is an ongoing discussion, and this is nothing new to our university either. There have been controversial things going on in the past that have raised questions about our Catholic identity. So, but this is, as I said, an ongoing conversation.
Well, Aaron Steiner, it sounds like a more intellectually vigorous debate than your average Glenn Beck show, I'm grateful to talk to you. Aaron Steiner is a junior at the Notre Dame University majoring in business and German, where President Obama will be speaking this weekend. Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
And Femi Okeh has the headlines now.
Thanks, John. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Starting today, California will send layoff notices to 5,000 state employees in the wake of a $15 billion state deficit. The layoffs will cut 5% of the state workforce. The U.S. Treasury has approved billions in bailout funds for six major insurance companies, including Allstate and the Prudential Financial. Under the TARP program, each of the companies is eligible for cash investments of up to 3% of its assets. President Obama is expected to tap the New York City Health Commissioner Thomas Frieden to lead the CDC today. He's an infectious disease specialist. And meanwhile, authorities have confirmed the fourth death in the United States from the H1N1 virus or swine flu. There are now almost 6,500 confirmed swine flu cases worldwide, and that's according to the World Health Organization. And that's a look at some of the top stories making headlines this morning. John.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm going to give you $300 a week. Yes, indeed. $300 a week, $1,200 a month. All right?
Great, I'll take it.
Yes, you will. And I will take $350 for taxes.
Whoa!
Huh? Yeah, because, see, the government comes for the regular people first. Now, how much does that leave you with?
$850.
All right. Now, you've got to have an apartment because you are not going to live here.
Little blast from the past there from a clip from the Cosby Show as Cliff Huxtable teaches his son Theo about the economics of living on his own as an adult. I think that was before Theo's voice changed, actually. Well, like we've been talking about all week, it's graduation season and many young adults will be going out into the real world on their own trying to get jobs and lives for their own in this terrible, terrible economy. Lots of graduating students will also be moving back in with their parents because of this terrible economy. And the question for parents right now is how much financial help should you give your adult children, no matter how old they are? Here to talk about this with us is Beth Kobliner. She's a personal financial expert and the author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. It's all about financial literacy for 20-somethings and Gen Xers. Beth, when should and shouldn't a parent help bail out their adult child from financial difficulty?
Right. I was just here wondering whether those Brady kids have ever moved out of their house. I don't know if
they're
I would. That's right.
Well, in their plaid shirts, yeah. Sorry.
Exactly. All listening to their parents in that tiny little house, even though the dad was an architect. But anyway, you know, I've been going around the country with Get a Financial Life, talking to dozens of colleges all over, to people in their 20s and early 30s, also talking at companies. And, you know, people at this age are so concerned right now. And you think about it, you know, they're graduating with, on average, $22,000 in student loans, $4,100 in credit card debt, and it's the worst job market in 25 years. So they are completely, you know, their pomp is being tempered by lousy circumstances.
Do we have data that a lot more kids are, in fact, moving back in with their parents? I mean, it
absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I've been watching this statistic for a very long time. Right now, the highest percentage of young people in their 20s and early 30s are moving back home with their parents. This is the highest percentage it's been since 1960. So when I talk at these colleges and I say, well, here's what you have to do. You have to move back home with your parents. They fall off their chairs, you know, after 4 years of college moving back home. And I said, if you feel bad, your parents feel really bad.
Mm-hmm. Well, kids in their 20s after college moving back in with mom and dad for a few months, it wasn't unheard of even when the economy was good. What about people in their 30s?
Yeah,
they've been on the job market for a few years.
You know, it's been a really tough time that when people in their 20s are losing their jobs, moving back home with their parents, some even with their own children moving back home. And it's a tricky balance, too, because their parents aren't having it so easy either. You know, they've seen their home values decline. They've seen their 401s cut in half, 401ks cut in half. So when it comes to who helps who and who's bailing out who, it gets very tricky.
Okay, so what are once the kids move back in, maybe not move back in, even just ask for some money, and not because they're lazy, but because it's the worst economy they've seen.
Right, in generations.
The worst in a generation. How do parents approach? How much money to give for how long? How should they approach
right.
this?
Well, the first thing is, if your grown kids move back home and they're having trouble, say, making a car payment, and they need that car to get to a job, if you can afford it, that's something you definitely want to help them with, something that's a necessity. But we're talking about a kid moving back after college who has, you know, $4,000 in high-rate credit card that he built up for eating pizza, you know, since freshman year. I think it's important not to pay that off, but you might want to help your kids prioritize. If they have student loans and credit cards, talk to them about paying off the high-rate debt more quickly than the lower-rate student loans. Mm. I think helping them get organized and figuring out what they need to do is really a very helpful way to help your kids.
How many motorcycles should a young person in their 20s actually bring home? Actually, that's not my real question. My real question is Beth, you know, on the long historical arc here, extended families were a way that Americans in the 1800s actually shared resources. I mean, it
Absolutely.
Was not unheard of. I mean, maybe we should go back to that.
I think we are seeing that. And I think the attitudes that I'm seeing, you know, I had one kid tell me the other day he had more in common with his grandparents than he does with his parents. He feels like his generation's going to have to scrimp and save. And, you know, they're trying to be more frugal and be more aware of the fact that, you know, maybe they will have to live with their parents for a longer period of time. And I think that helps them sort of keep things in mind. That's why we're seeing volunteerism go up. But I think when it comes to moving back in with your parents, parents also have to realize they have to put on their so-called oxygen mask first, you know, because if they are about to retire or nearing retirement in their 50s or 60s, they want to start saving. They have to continue to save in their 401ks and their IRAs and not sacrifice the money they would have been saving for their own retirement by giving it to their grown kids. But it's tough. You know, parents want to help out their kids, generally speaking. So it's a hard balance to figure out.
Well, Beth, have you noticed any cultural, I want to ask you real quick, any cultural differences? I know that for a lot of Latino Americans, Hispanic Americans, it's actually very common and normal to move back in with your folks or stay living with your folks until you're married. But everybody's right. Facing this economy. Have you noticed any differences there?
I do. You know, it's interesting how when I go to some of the private schools, you know, I've been at Harvard and Georgetown and sort of some of the fancier schools where the kids have a little bit more money, they're more devastated because they say, oh, my gosh, you know, I thought I can just get a loan and get an apartment of my own. Their expectations were much greater. When I've talked at more public colleges or community college, those kids are saying, well, we knew we had to move back anyway, so we're not all that upset about it. But they are upset about the fact that the, you know, unemployment is double the rate it is for the average public for people in their 20s. So they're very nervous about how they can, you know, get ahead. And as the, of course, the American dream is do better than the next generation. But I do think there's some commonality there.
This economy is not only affecting everybody's checkbooks, but also how they're living, whether they're living together or apart, whether they're living with their parents. Beth Kobliner is a personal finance expert and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. Thanks, Beth. All right. Well, Femi is now here with headlines.
Thank you very much. Just in now, the consumer price index was unchanged in April, and over the past year, it's down by the largest amount in half a century. The consumer price index tracks the average price of a specific group of goods and services from month to month, and it also helps track inflation. Former top Bush advisor Karl Rove is expected to be questioned today by a special prosecutor. That's part of an ongoing probe into whether the Bush administration officials should face criminal charges in the firings of 9 U.S. attorneys back in 2006. Rove had refused to be interviewed by an earlier Justice Department inquiry. In a major policy shift, President Obama is expected to announce today that he's restarting military trials for some detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Aides say that detainees' rights will be better protected under a new military court system at Guantanamo, which would ban evidence obtained from cruel treatment. In international news, Pope Benedict is on his way home after a week-long tour of the Middle East. On his last day in Israel, the Pope strongly condemned the Holocaust as, and I'm going to quote here, a brutal extermination of Jews by a godless Nazi regime, end of quote. During the trip, the Pope faced criticism that he hadn't sufficiently apologised for Nazi atrocities. Let's look at stories making headlines this morning. Todd.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Here's
and,
John Hockenberry. There he's jumping.
And I'm John Hockenberry. I got one word for you, Todd. Eurovision. Actually, Eurovision isn't a word, but if you're in Europe, Eurovision is inescapable. It's a national song pageant that sweeps the continent and other places around North Africa and the Middle East. Countries enter songs, and there's a competition that culminates in the finals, which take place this weekend in Moscow. And Eurovision is so huge, we wanted to get a read on why we should pay any attention to this whatsoever from Paul Henley, BBC reporter in Moscow, who's covering the Eurovision contest. There's really no pageantry like Eurovision, right, Paul?
No, it's a tasteless spectacular. It's one of the events of the year, and you can't miss that it's on in Moscow this week.
sort of arguably on the same level as hosting the Olympics or the World Cup. It's supposed to be a big party, you know, fun, but it's very serious, especially for Russians anticipating making a national statement on the European stage. It's a big deal.
In fact, when I was based in Jerusalem, it was the gigantic Eurovision coverage that first familiarized me with this pageant. But as any pageant in an international context, it can become a showcase for politics. And in this case, homosexual rights in Russia are at center stage at Eurovision.
Yeah, this is a grand television event watched by 150 million people, and it's a very camp event, essentially. A lot of Western European fans are attracted to this for its kind of, over-the-top status, and it has a lot of gay fans, and there's an interesting culture clash going on in what is a fairly intensely homophobic place, Moscow, where the gay scene is underground, and where you have huge armies of gay fans here being entertained by a host which has banned a gay pride parade, which is timed to coincide handily with Eurovision on Saturday, and where there's been a lot of violence in the past, with the authorities saying if they do stage this event, they'll crack down and there will be nasty scenes, and that will be an interesting thing to find on the television cameras all over the world. People are poised to cover that, absolutely.
And there's a couple that's actually confronted Moscow directly by trying to get married this weekend. They've been refused. How's that going to play?
Two women who tried to get married and were turned down when they got to the office where they wanted to seal their marriage. No surprise there at all. Russia is a long way off gay marriage. Public opinion really is not on their side. The line from religious people and from conservative people here is that homosexuals are trying to dismantle the state, that they are a threat to normal society. And a lot of people would agree with that. Whether this event makes a statement about that is questionable. Is this theatre? Is Eurovision about music? Is it about culture? Is it trash? Is it politics? I suppose the answer is it's all of those, actually.
Well, what is the chance that the headlines on Monday morning are going to be of a tear gas confrontation between religious Russians and gay activists on the streets of Moscow while this Songfest is going on?
There's a strong chance that those could be the headlines. Don't underestimate the force of the headline on who's won Eurovision. That would probably come first. But, you know, with a contest watched by this many people. But, yeah, there are so many television crews, newspaper writers here interested in this clash of cultures that there'll be a massive concentration on whatever happens should that gay pride march go ahead on Saturday.
Well, here's Russia's entry to the Eurovision contest, and whether it is a confrontation between gay rights activists and Russian authorities, we will see. Paul Hanley, BBC reporter in Moscow, thanks.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Todd Zwillick. And for graduation time, Todd was talking with Beth, what was her name?
My God. Kobliner.
Kobliner, yes. I had it and then lost it. Anyway, Beth Kobliner and Todd were talking about using your parents as a bailout, which provoked this story.
My name is Christina. After my son spent $80,000 in graduate school a year ago, he still hasn't found a job in his field, and I offered that he could move here until he got squared away so he wouldn't have to bother his friends.
Very nice. But someone named Juice on our website wrote about his parents. I know my parents would like to help me out more, and money is tight, but sometimes their priorities are aggravating. Their booze budget alone is comparable to what I live off, and whenever we eat out, which can be as often as once a week, I think about asking for the cash instead of ordering and eating later. Anything you have to say on what's going on in the show, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And now Femi Oke has some headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Starting today, California will send layoff notices to 5,000 state employees in the wake of a $15 billion state deficit. The layoffs affect 5% of the state workforce. Later today, GM is expected to announce that it's closing at least 1,100 dealerships. Earlier this week, Chrysler announced that it's closing a quarter of its dealerships. In international news, a senior envoy for the United Nations is in Sri Lanka today for possible ceasefire talks. The government has rejected all calls so far to end fighting against Tamil Tiger rebels. UN spokeswoman Amari Akobi says that Secretary General Ban Ki-moon also made a personal appeal.
The Secretary General has urged the government of Sri Lanka to explore all possible options to bring the conflict to an end without further bloodshed and to make public the terms under which that can be achieved without further loss of civilian life.
Tens of thousands of ethnic Tamil civilians remain trapped inside the war zone. Many there are hiding to avoid the violence, digging bunkers and hiding under ruined buildings. As a look at stories making news this morning, John.
Thank you, Femi. We've been talking all hour about the issues of judicial treatment of detainees at Abu Ghraib and other places during the Bush administration. It's turning out to be a big issue in the early days of the Obama administration, and particularly those photos that President Obama does not want to have released to the public. Photos that, according to the ACLU, show something of a culture of permissiveness in the military as regards abuse of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. Here's the president talking about his reasons, though, for not releasing these new photos.
It's therefore my belief that the publication of these photos would not add any additional benefit to our understanding of what was carried out in the past by a small number of individuals. In fact, the most direct consequence of releasing them, I believe, would be to further inflame anti-American opinion and to put our troops in greater danger.
Here in the studio is Philip Gurevich, who's the co-author of The Ballad of Abu Ghraib and editor of the Paris Review. He's seen lots and lots of these photos, and we asked him to talk with us for a few minutes about the context of what Barack Obama has decided to do, not release photos. It seems to me what we're seeing here, Philip, is the inherent contradiction between trying to project transparency in a new administration and trying to improve America's image in the world, which is also a major mission of Barack Obama. Are these contradictory, irreconcilable in some way?
Well, no. I think that a certain degree of transparency and improving America's image in the world, specifically as it pertains to the issue of torture and the practices of the Bush administration's torture policy during the war on terror, they go together very well. One should remember that what he's trying to do is balance those conjoined purposes with ramping up the war in one of its hot theaters in Afghanistan along the Pakistan border, where he's actually increasing the troop numbers and in a dangerous situation. And so he's talking to military advisors, and he's saying, look, there is a possibility, and this seemed to have been agreed upon by everybody, including most reporters who were in Iraq at the time that the Abu Ghraib photographs came out, that the release of such photographs would not change or add to our understanding that this was policy, that it was widespread, and that we now know more and more and more about torture. And yet it would have a sensational effect and a possibly inflammatory effect that would endanger people.
How do you know that or come to that conclusion in the amount of the photographs that you've looked at? Because you've looked at an enormous number of these.
Well, the photographs themselves don't endanger anybody. It's the practices that are depicted in the photographs that endanger the troops, presumably, because what they show you is that America's engaged in systematic physical and psychological abuse of captured people, some of them combatants, some of them innocents, in the countries where we're fighting these wars. When the Abu Ghraib photographs came out, they performed a tremendous public service. Whether or not that was the intention of the soldiers who appeared in them and took them, their release ran directly against a policy of deception and secrecy of the administration, whose policies it was to create this permission and have these practices taking place in all of the prisons that they were running for interrogation. Now it's a different story.
But I wonder, if that argument had been made to you and Errol Morris, who collaborated on a movie which showed a lot of these photos, if they had made the argument to you that, no, actually, having these photos in the hands of a filmmaker, even a talented, sensitive writer such as yourself, would endanger the troops. It would not serve any purpose. We know the abuse took place, period. That's the end of it.
You know, the argument was made the same that the photographs endangered the troops by the Bush administration. The interesting thing is that they have a contradictory logic. Cheney's out there right now saying that these practices, the torture, made our troops safer. And now he's also tried to say that the photographs made the troops more dangerous. The Bush administration put all of the focus on the photographs. In their mind, the crime at Abu Ghraib was the photographs. Mm. The only people who've ever been punished for Bush-era torture policies are the soldiers who appeared in and took the photographs at Abu Ghraib. Nobody else.
No commanders.
No commanders, nobody in any other theater, nobody in any other prison in the theater, nobody at any other stage. The photographs became the crime. And in fact, part of the problem is when we see photographs, we have this illusion that we know what we're seeing. We think that we know the whole story. And the expose ultimately became something of the cover-up at Abu Ghraib. And I think the notion that we should get so caught up right now in thinking that without these photographs, we don't know what happened, that's not true. Without these photographs or with these photographs, what we need to keep doing is chipping away towards knowing more and more and more and putting that picture together, which, frankly, the Obama administration has led us on more than the press, more than any advocacy group in the last few months.
You know, Philip, though, there is an essential mystery, and I wonder if you agree with me on this, and I don't know if any photo resolves it, and that is, why did they take the pictures? Why did each soldier take the picture? Did you puzzle on that?
I wrote a lot about it in the Ballad of Abu Ghraib. They had different motives, which is often the case. You have a group of half a dozen people, and they have a half a dozen reasons. One of the main group of Abu Ghraib photographs was largely taken by two people. One of them was a young MP named Sabrina Harmon. And in civilian life, her aspiration was actually to become a forensic photographer, a crime scene photographer. She liked to look at things and take photographs of things that puzzled her and that troubled her. And when she arrived at Abu Ghraib and was put on this military intelligence, high-value detainee cell block, she found all of these prisoners trussed, naked, bound in stress positions with panties on their heads, and she started photographing them. The early photographs are almost exactly like documentary photographs. Mm. And she started writing home, and we have these letters at the same time saying, this is the most troubling thing. Nobody would ever believe us if we didn't show you what it looks like. I have proof. And she started imagining, someday I'll show this to the world. Charles Grainer took the other bunch, and he appears in them, and he was much more into posing in the photographs himself. But he, too, kept saying, we have proof, we have proof. And he would show these photographs to his commanders. He'd say, is it okay if we do this? Is it all right if we do this? Some of those photographs that look like torture photographs are torture photographs. Some of them are photographs of mentally ill patients who were stuck on that same cell block, and they were trying to restrain from hurting themselves. They would take these photographs and show them to medics. They showed them to JAG lawyers in the military. These photographs had a lot of uses and abuses.
Well, they're irrevocably a part of the discourse, which describes what happened during the Bush years at places like Abu Ghraib. Philip Gorevitch, thanks so much for being with us. He's the co-author of The Ballad of Abu Ghraib and editor of the Paris Review. Todd?
All right. There is a foreseeable end to the 40-year war on drugs in America with Barack Obama's new drugs czar. Find out more on our website, thetakeaway.org. So we want to get your take. What do we do with drugs in America? Maybe we need a new phrase, the what on drugs.
Troy calling from North Dakota. The war on drugs could be renamed Narco Polo, like with an N, or you could go Shakespearean and call it Much Ado About Doobies.
Tell us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
That's our Troy.
If you want to catch up on politics, you can follow me around Washington by subscribing to my Twitter feed. I'll tweet for you, as they say, at thetakeaway.org.
They say you said it.
I said it. And
tweet
lots of people say that, John. Yeah, and while you're
sure
at the website,
of course they do.
Check out some new videos. Follow Pomp in these circumstances. The troubles that face new graduates in these tough times. Is all that student debt really worth it?
They're graduating with, on average, $22,000 in student loans, $4,100 in credit card debt, and it's the worst job market in 25 years. You know, their pomp is being tempered by lousy circumstances.
That's Beth Kobliner, author of Get a Financial Life in These Financial Times. That's The Takeaway.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
America is at war. The enemy lurks beyond our border, and it threatens us from within, and the very lives of our children are at stake.
Cowabunga!
Hey, Joey, I got some stuff you just gotta try.
What is it?
Pot. You know, marijuana.
And the
the next commercial is...
This Bud's for you.
Come on, America. Let's be hypocritical bastards. Come on. It's okay to drink your drug. We meant those other drugs. Those untaxed drugs.
America's drug warriors are realizing they might not be able to beat the enemy. And if they can't beat them, is it time to join them?
Cowabunga!
It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, May 15th. I'm Todd Zwillick here with John Hockenberry. Hey there, John.
You're our teenage mutant ninja Zwillick. Good morning, Todd. Coming up this hour, we hear both sides of the energy debate, talking with the new EPA administrator, Lisa Jackson, and then Republican Congressman Fred Upton, senior member of the House Energy Committee. And we ask about a place where the economy is actually improving, the West African Republic of Ghana. Those stories coming up. But first, these headlines. And in the headlines, it's a major policy shift. President Obama is expected to hold military tribunals for a small number of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Those tribunals are expected to have more legal rights this time around. But Christine Husky, a lawyer for two of the detainees, says they're not the best option.
The truth is, you're going to have to change them so much so that they practically look like the federal courts. So then why not just try them in federal court?
Administration aides say some defendants will still be tried in civilian courts. In Pakistan, thousands of people are streaming into refugee camps seeking relief from the conflict in the northwest Swat Valley. The military has lifted the curfew to make it easier to leave. The UN, meanwhile, is calling for a massive emergency injection of aid to improve conditions in the refugee camps. Todd?
In Israel, Pope Benedict has strongly condemned the Holocaust as a, quote, brutal extermination of Jews by a godless Nazi regime. The remarks come as the Pope prepared to leave the country after his eight-day tour of the Middle East. During the trip, he faced criticism that he'd failed to sufficiently apologize for Nazi atrocities. The Pope, of course, previously belonged to the Hitler Youth when he was a youth in his native Germany. North Korea says all contracts for the joint industrial complex it shares with South Korea are now invalid. The North is planning to draw up its own regulations on wages and taxes. It says North Korean companies must accept the new regulations or leave the complex near the border. In horse racing, tomorrow is the Preakness, the middle jewel in the Triple Crown. Derby winner Mind That Bird will be at the Baltimore race, though with a different jockey. His previous rider will be aboard Philly favorite Rachel Alexandra.
GM expected to announce it's closing at least 1,100 dealerships. Chrysler announced earlier this week it's closing a quarter of its dealerships. Panasonic announced a $4 billion loss in the past fiscal year. And all that adds to economic woes. The consumer price index flat last month, which is what analysts expected. It may sound like good news, but it's more a sign of economic shrinkage. The S&P begins trading today at 893 after a rise of about 1% yesterday. As Todd mentioned at the top, cowabunga, there's a foreseeable end to the 40-year war on drugs. The administration wants to move away from the war on drugs. Fill in the blank. It's a blank on drugs. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Join a debate on decriminalization, won't you?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. We begin this hour with Lisa Jackson, who is the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, arguably the chief enforcement officer of Barack Obama's environmental policy as it develops. Congress is expected to begin debate in consideration of a very complex bill on climate change. Climate change, arguably, is the top issue on the environmental agenda in the early days of the Obama administration. Administrator Jackson, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
So if we talk about climate change and this bill that is supposed to be emerging from Ed Markey and Henry Waxman's congressional offices at any moment, is the EPA in a proper legislative posture to regulate the environment to produce real changes in the climate?
Yeah, well, the bill that you're referring to, the American Clean Energy and Security Act, actually establishes a market-based cap-and-trade program, and so EPA would be a big player if that program comes to be. And when that happens, certainly we'd need to gear up. But one of the things we've started to do already is put out a rule to measure greenhouse gas emissions. Obviously, you can't monitor what you don't measure, so that's our first step.
So if you measure carbon, and if carbon dioxide has been found to be a danger of human health and welfare, overturning, you know, all kinds of policy and approaches in the Bush administration, doesn't the EPA have its own regulatory power to regulate carbon because it is a health hazard?
Yeah, well, we're in the middle of a process right now. You're right. EPA has a finding out called an endangerment finding that does make the finding, contrary to what was done in the last administration, that greenhouse gases endanger human public health and welfare. And that's the first step towards regulation. We don't have regulations on the street right now, but they could come about once the endangerment finding is completed.
Do you need to wait for Congress, or can you move ahead with that finding?
Yeah, that finding's independent of what's happening in Congress right now.
Well, Ms. Jackson, we had tape of Congressman Joe Barton from Texas the other day saying unequivocally and clearly, quote, cap and trade is dead. That it's his view, and he's been in Congress, 30 years, that cap and trade won't get out of committee and won't ultimately pass. I don't know if he's right or wrong, but if he turns out to be right, what options does EPA or the government have for addressing climate change if cap and trade isn't part of the bill?
Well, I'm happy to answer your question. I have to start by saying I certainly hope he's not right. The president has called on Congress to pass comprehensive energy legislation. That includes the cap and trade and lots of good things to jumpstart a green energy economy for our country. If he is right, then yes, EPA could be expected to move towards a regulatory posture on greenhouse gas emissions. Most of the time when people ask me where we go first, I say, listen, EPA would use common sense. The biggest emitters of greenhouse gases are in our transportation sector, the cars and trucks on the road, and then utilities, the way we generate power.
So that means you go to each of the sources of carbon individually or severally and limit their emissions that way to the utilities, to the autos, down the line. But EPA doesn't have the ability to cap and trade or anything like cap and trade on its own, correct?
Yeah, that's an open question, John. A lot of lawyers, and I'm not one, have looked at it. Most believe that it would be very difficult to establish a cap and trade program for greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. It would certainly be challenged in court. So at a minimum, we know we'd be looking at many years of litigation before we were able to establish it if it held up in court.
Well, that really sets up it seems to me, the bedeviling contradiction in this bill and as the debate goes forward in Congress and in the administration. As Todd was just saying, market-based solutions like cap and trade, while attractive and attractive to you, as you've just said, are not necessarily authorizable by the EPA and will require Congress to move forward on them. Yet we already seen in this bill there are thousands of constituencies that are going to be addressed here, and it's already been watered down. At what point does this bill cease to be useful to the EPA in trying to make significant changes, and you just walk away from Congress and go it alone?
You know, we're far from that point. I know there's lots of talk around the bill, but I think all eyes will be on the committee, on its work on Monday. There's been tremendous work done already by the chairman, Henry Waxman, and Ed Markey, the subcommittee chair, and lots of good, productive discussions. You know, if we're going to get a market-based solution that sticks for energy in this country, it's going to require all those voices at the table, and then the really hard work of coming to consensus and putting forward a good bill.
Well, hard work indeed. Hard work indeed, and especially the voices on the Republican side are calling cap and trade a tax on energy throughout the economy. Lisa Jackson, Administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, thanks so much for joining us. She joined us from her office in Washington.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Todd.
All right, thanks. Well, John, now joining us on the line is Congressman Fred Upton. He's a Republican from Michigan. He's also a senior Republican on the Energy and Commerce Committee. That's the committee that's going to be marking up, in other words, processing and amending the climate change cap and trade bill next week. Mr. Upton, how are you?
Hey, good morning. You can call me Fred.
You always say that, and I always call you Congressman.
That's the way. That's Steve.
Thanks, Mr. Upton. Thanks, Congressman. Hey, thanks for joining us. Mr. Barton, Joe Barton, the senior Republican on your committee, said into our microphones the other day, cap and trade is dead. Call the coroner. It's dead. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's not dead yet. I think ultimately it will be. And one of the reasons why Chairman Waxman decided to forego the subcommittee, you know, we've had, I don't know how many hearings, dozens and dozens of them since the first of the year, over 300 witnesses, some of the hearings lasting 9 or 10 hours apiece. And all of a sudden, the chairman pulled the subcommittee out of it because he realized that after all of those deliberations, he didn't have the votes. And so he moved it to full committee. So it's going to be a very close vote next week when we likely conclude things, probably Thursday or Friday. We start Monday, as Administrator Jackson indicated. It's likely to, you know, if it passes, it's only going to pass by one or two at the most.
Right.
And then it goes to the House floor. And I'll tell you, a number of Democrats, particularly what we call blue dog Democrats, but from states that have pretty good coal populations, you take a look at Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Illinois, some of those states are over 90% coal. Their utility bills are going to go up 40 to 50%. Of course, you can take some of the money collected from this tax and rebate them in some form, but the businesses still have to pay it.
Right, and your leadership has certainly been targeting those moderate Democrats and trying to fire up their constituencies so that they, you know, calling it a tax on the Midwest.
Well, that's in essence what it is. And the other thing is that the Senate last month had a vote as part of the budget debate as to whether or not cap and trade should be included as reconciliation or not. If it's part of reconciliation, it cannot be filibustered. You only need 50 votes to pass it instead of 60. And guess what? By a 2-to-1 basis in the Senate, which is in essence 60-40 now, as you know, for the Democrats, the Senate said no. It's got to come up
right
under regular order, so it's got to get 60 votes. So they clearly don't have the votes there, which brings us back to the same parallel that we saw back in 1993 when Bill Clinton wanted a BTU tax, and that's exactly what it was. The House passed it narrowly, 219 to 213, and the Senate said, forget it. We're not taking it up.
Congressman, isn't there a problem here, though? I mean, a lot of your colleagues on the Republican side of the aisle talk about market-based solutions always being a better approach to these kinds of things. If cap-and-trade doesn't get some sort of support and continues to be called a tax on energy, and I'm not going to debate the language there, aren't you stuck with regulations that are even more expensive? Something's going to be done on carbon, and a market-based approach is probably more fair. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I'm not sure that that's right, because we think that you can actually reduce emissions, and I'm one that does believe that the planet is warming, and we need to take steps to reduce it. I think that we can. We can do it with greater efficiencies. We can require clean coal technology, something, by the way, that's just as assumed in this bill, but we actually—it's at least 10 years away. There's no nuclear title in it at all, which is a major flaw. Which, of course, nuclear, as you know, has no greenhouse gas emissions. So, I mean, there's a whole number of things that we can do to reduce emissions, to building standards. Yes, there'll be even more on the autos. A whole number of different things, and at the end of the day, you'd have a bipartisan bill and something, frankly, that the Senate is pursuing without a cap and trade.
Congressman Fred Upton from Kalamazoo, Michigan. He's a senior member of the Energy and Commerce Committee. He'll be a big part of the markup next week in the committee as climate change and cap and trade come to the forefront. Congressman, thanks so much for being with us. That's going to be a big debate next week, John. There's going to be a lot of
debate over taxes, though. I don't think it's going to go anywhere.
Well,
it becomes like, do we want a tax? Do we not want a tax?
It's all going to depend on how many of these moderates the GOP wins over with the rhetoric and with the idea that people in the Midwest and consumers are going to have to pay more. It's going to be very interesting.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual. dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Todd Zwillick. I'm here with John Hockenberry. There is a foreseeable end to the 40-year war on drugs. Find out more coming up in the show, but we want to get your take.
I would like to see that war ended. It's another costly war against an ideal that can't be won. There are no armies to crush, no cities to take. It's not a war you can effectively win.
So what do we do with drugs in America? Maybe we need a new phrase. The what in America? The blank on drugs. Tell us your new phrase at 8778-MY-TAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org, John.
So, you know, the problem in this whole economic mess that we're in, I mean, if you think about it, is that Americans tend to stay put in a country that has an economic shrinkage going on. The GDP over the last two quarters has actually been shrinking in the U.S. So to fix that for yourself personally, you need to get out of the U.S. Grab your passport, hop on a plane, and go somewhere where the economy is actually growing by 4, 5, or 6%.
Everything a businessman needs to do business and succeed is certainly present in Ghana.
Ghana, not China, Ghana. Ghana in West Africa. BBC chief economics correspondent Hugh Pym recently returned to London from a reporting trip in this surprisingly prosperous nation. And we spoke to him earlier this morning. I started our interview with this question. So what economic advantages does a nation like Ghana have, and how are they playing out in this recession, which has produced so much economic hardship in many places around the world that are actually dependent on prosperity and growth in the West and in places like China?
Well, crucially, John, there was no subprime banking crisis. There is not much of a banking system in many of these African countries. But what is there is not tainted by collapses and loans that have gone wrong. And I was very struck by the vibrancy of one bank I went to, started up 3 years ago. They're aiming to double their branches from 10 to 20 this year. And they are doing it the old-fashioned way, building up savings from people, going out and lending, and quite confident about the future. Obviously, expanding banking across quite a rural nation like Ghana is going to be difficult, but there are great advances they hope to make in mobile phone banking. So I got a general mood of optimism about the future because they still had positive growth and they didn't have a banking crisis, and they expect more positive growth over the next few years.
Give us a little insight into the unique qualities of Ghana. I mean, this nation doesn't sit on some deposit of bauxite or something and can basically make a lot of cash by selling aluminum ore. Is it the fact that Ghana is an all-cash economy that shielded it from the subprime mortgage crisis and other sorts of bank default issues?
Well, it does have commodities, as you mentioned, like bauxite and cocoa and gold. And I think the issue there is to increase the efficiency of how they produce it. They're also going to bring oil onshore for the first time at the end of next year. I spoke to the finance minister and he said, I'm not being complacent, but in a few years' time we'll have gold and oil, which is not a bad place to be. So there are those commodities for them to develop. But there's also a sense of entrepreneurialism, particularly in the capital, Accra, a sort of get-up-and-go mentality. And I met a couple of people who'd come back to Ghana, one from the City of London, one from Wall Street. They'd both worked in banking in those communities. They decided they'd rather be back home running businesses there. So a sort of excitement and a bit of a buzz in terms of the people who want to go places in business.
Does Accra have the kind of real estate bubble problems that a place like Luanda down in Angola has, where expats go there? And of course, there's an oil-producing country, Angola. People go there and end up spending more for a smaller space in an African capital than they do in a place like London or Paris.
No, because the mortgage market is not really that well developed. It's quite a small minority who have access to mortgage funding at the moment. But the mortgages that are now being offered and expanded by that banker that I referred to earlier, they're looking to people to put up 40% of a deposit, so they'll lend 60%. So there's rather a more prudent attitude to lending. So maybe there won't be a housing boom. But clearly when oil comes onshore, at the end of next year, 2010, that might fuel the sort of problems that you were referring to in terms of pushing up real estate. But there's a determination I detected that they didn't want to let oil distort their economy. They wanted to make oil work for everybody in a sort of sensible long-term fashion.
And an incredibly vibrant music scene in Accra, I should point out, by the way. Ghana is a great sort of pop culture capital there in Africa. Finally, is the takeaway here that cash economies, nations that don't rely on either international credit and do a lot of smaller transactions with much of it in cash, you talked about a 40% deposit in this particular instance, do they have an advantage over other economies in an environment like this?
Well, they do, in the sense that savings are not at risk and there's not a worry amongst consumers. They don't want to put money away safely because they're worried about losing it. But there's an opportunity that's been identified by businesses. I was there with a group of international business people, some from banking, an opportunity to allow people to carry out transactions in the way that we're familiar with through banking rather than doing them in the informal economy that you referred to. And that's a great opportunity for banks to come in and offer those sort of services, like on mobile phones, for example, leapfrogging, going over the branch sort of banking culture we're used to, straight onto mobiles right out around the country. I should point out, just as a final thought, John, you know, this is a country that isn't completely perfect. They have a budget deficit. They have a government that is dealing with borrowing money overseas. They're not being complacent about that. They have quite high inflation. But, I mean, who doesn't have problems at the moment? And
right.
I think we shouldn't criticize Ghana and other countries for having to borrow a lot when you certainly look at the U.S. and the U.K. as pretty large borrowers out there.
Well, and the U.S. and the U.K. would envy the problems that Ghana has at this point, that's for sure. The U.S. government just announced that industrial production is down by 0.5%. My guest was Hugh Pym, chief economic correspondent for our partners, the BBC. In that interview conducted earlier this morning, he was talking about how prudence is helping Ghana to survive the economic downturn. Now, Femi Okeh is here with the headlines.
At 27 minutes past the hour, former top Bush advisor Karl Rove is expected to be questioned today by a special prosecutor. It's part of an ongoing probe into whether Bush administration officials should face criminal charges in the firings of 9 U.S. attorneys in 2006. Today, President Obama is expected to announce that he's reopening military trials for some detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Aides say detainees' rights will be better protected under a new military court system, which would ban evidence obtained from cruel treatment. In international news, Pakistan has temporarily lifted a military curfew in much of the Swat Valley to let civilians flee the fighting there. Thousands are streaming into Pakistani refugee camps. The United Nations says that conditions in the camps are harsh and it's calling for an immediate injection of aid. Pope Benedict is on his way home after a week-long tour of the Middle East. On his last day in Israel, the Pope strongly condemned the Holocaust as, and I'm going to quote him here, a brutal extermination of Jews by a godless Nazi regime, end of quote. During the trip, the Pope faced criticism that he hadn't sufficiently apologised for Nazi atrocities. And in economic news, the first quarter of 2009 for Germany, it suffered its largest economic contraction since reunification. And that is a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. 40 years of the war on drugs, and the Obama administration might just say, never mind. Getting away from the idea of the war on drugs from the Nixon administration, what do we do with the slogan? If Obama wants to get rid of it, what do we have? The blank on drugs? Carrie from Detroit, help us out here.
My take on the war on drugs is to educate. It's education on drugs. Educating kids, parents, adults, agencies, government, and everyone that there is an alternative.
fill in the blank at 877-8-MY-TAKE. The War on Drugs, not something else. Email mytake@thetakeaway.org. Todd?
John, after we covered the Kentucky Derby earlier this month, Judith Mason posted a comment on our website. She's a veterinarian. She said, thoroughbred racing involves the racing of juvenile or growing horses, and it's both unnatural and harmful to the animals. Why don't you cover that aspect, or will you wait until another horse is euthanized on the track from a cataclysmic injury? Well, the second race of the Triple Crown is the Preakness. It's being run tomorrow, so we thought that now would be a good time to address Dr. Mason's comment. With us to do just that is Sally Jenkins. She's sports writer for the Washington Post, who wrote a column critical of thoroughbred racing after the filly Eight Bells had to be euthanized on the track at last year's Kentucky Derby. Sally, do you basically agree with our listeners, the veterinarian's comment on the website that horse racing is unnatural and harmful and basically cruel to animals?
Well, I don't agree entirely. I know what she's saying, and I think that she has a couple of good points contained in her email. I would disagree that it's unnatural. If you go to any horse farm in Ocala, Florida, you'll see the yearlings racing around the fields. They love to compete, and they love to play, and they love to run. So I don't believe it's unnatural. I do believe that American horse racing has fallen down on its responsibilities to the horses, and I think they've got a lot of work to do to take better care of the animals and make it not a harmful sport.
You know, Sally, I have a real problem as a dad here. I've got four kids that love to watch the race. They actually go down to their grandma's house and watch the races every year this season. But the last couple of years, it's had such a horrifying end. My kids really don't know what to make of this sport. It does project cruelty when you kill horses right there at the track.
Well, I've done the same. I've watched the races since I was a girl, and this is the first time in memory that I've had to wince as the starting gate opens. I really have begun, because of what happened to Eight Bells and to Barbro, to cringe at these races, and also the more I've learned about the safety records of the tracks and the treatment of the animals makes you wince. Obviously, North American horse racing had gotten out of hand in some of its practices. They have been breeding the horses far too finely, breeding them with an eye towards short-term speed and early success, as opposed to durability and maturity. They have not been very attentive to the content of the track that the horse is running on. They've not been very, I think, responsible about drugs administered to the horses that mask injuries that can lead to catastrophic breakdown.
Well, I want to ask you about drugs, Sally, because you mentioned that the treatment of the horses overall, you know, that horses, the yearlings, have a pretty comfortable life on breeding farms in Kentucky and Maryland and other places. But what about the drugs? There's been a lot of pressure on the industry to come clean about steroid use or other drug use in these horses. Apparently the industry refuses to do it, but that falls under the rubric of unnatural, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There needs to be a zero tolerance policy on North American tracks. I don't think steroids ought to be administered to these animals. They're performance enhancing. They create unnatural physiques in some cases in young horses whose skeletal structure and bone structure is not yet fully mature. Joe Drape of the New York Times has done some of the best work on this. He tried to get the medical records on the horses entered into the Kentucky Derby, and only one or two horse owners and breeders were willing to cooperate with him. It's time to open the books on what trainers are administering these animals. There's medical care, which is one thing, and then there's horse doping, which is an entirely different subject.
And there's the chronic health and drug use in these horses, and there's the acute injuries, which wind up before the public, like John's kids, and people see these. Barbro was a horse that was famously injured and died in 2007. Eight Bells had to be euthanized on the track in front of millions of viewers. Sally, did those incidents do anything to change the industry, change racing, or even nudge it towards change, or have they been basically ignored?
There's been a lot of discussion. I mean, let me say this. The people inside horse racing have been truly agonized about this. The people that I've met inside thoroughbred racing really care about the sport and care about the animals. They love the animals, and there's a satisfaction that can be gotten from working with these animals that's not found in any other sport. That said, you know, it's unfortunate that more trainers and more owners didn't open up to Joe Drape and discuss, you know, what's the medication that's being administered to the animals. Now, 8 Bells was found not to have had any of those substances. Her breakdown really was, purely a physical one. She ran a very hard race and collapsed at the end of it. I don't think she was a doped-up horse. There's nothing to suggest that.
But in too young, possibly, for the abuse, and genetically,
well,
maybe?
I think perhaps genetically too fine. One of the things that's I'm glad to see Rachel Alexander, the new super filly that's going to be entered in the Preakness, that I'm very anxious to see. Apparently, her breeding is much more sort of towards stamina and durability, as well as speed, and that's the sort of thing you need to see. So, but that's a separate issue from the doping. You know, in other countries, there is a zero tolerance towards doping. You're not allowed to give the horse anything unless it's for medical reasons, and if you do give a horse something, there's a period in which the horse has to sit out and not race. So I just think that in general, there are much more lax rules in this country about racing, and that leads to the fact that we have the highest mortality rate of any country that does engage in thoroughbred racing.
Well, America will hopefully be thinking about that. In the state of racing, we'll certainly be thinking about injuries and the euthanization of past horses as we watch the Preakness this weekend. Sally Jenkins, thanks for joining us to talk about the state of thoroughbred racing. And now with the state of the news and the headlines, it's Femi.
Thank you very much indeed. Hundreds of GM dealerships are waiting to find out this morning whether their franchise agreements will be renewed. The Detroit automaker says it will notify 1,100 dealers today that it's cutting them. And this comes a day after Chrysler shed almost 800 of its dealerships. Former top Bush advisor Karl Rove is expected to be questioned today by a special prosecutor. That's part of an ongoing probe into whether Bush administration officials should face criminal charges in the firings of 9 U.S. attorneys in 2006. Rove had refused to testify in an earlier Justice Department inquiry. Starting today, California will send layoff notices to 5,000 state employees. This comes in the wake of $15 billion state deficit, and the layoffs will cut 5% of the state workforce. In sports, Michael Phelps is back racing after being banned from competition after being pictured smoking drugs. Phelps will be competing in North Carolina tonight, and he says he has a plan.
I'm just going to hop in the water and see what happens. We've been training the last probably about 8 weeks, and I've lost a bunch of weight, and just going to see where we stand right now and see what we have to do between now and World Champ Trials.
And we'll keep track of Michael Phelps, see how he does. He intends to take part in the next Summer Olympics, which happens in the United Kingdom.
There's a lot of things I could say there, but I did.
And you're biting your tongue?
Yes.
This just in.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. Thousands of people today are fleeing the Swat Valley in northwest Pakistan, taking advantage of a temporary lifting of a curfew there. This is days after days of intense fighting between government troops and Taliban militants. For more on the ongoing crisis, we spoke with Nazis Afros, Asia editor at our partners, the BBC, earlier this morning. Nazis joined us from London. When we spoke, I asked Nazis to give us the latest word from his reporters on the ground in Pakistan.
We have been sending reporters for the last few days, ever since the refugees started arriving in the adjoining areas of the Swat Valley. One of our reporters went this morning in Mardan when we heard that the government and the army, they lifted the curfew, which they imposed in the whole of Swat Valley. He saw hundreds of buses, trucks, cars and taxis bringing refugees out of Swat Valley. We already know UNHCR, they had registered more than 800,000 refugees in the past 1 week or so. And the feeling is that because the curfew has been lifted, there'll be a lot more people coming out. These are the people who were completely trapped in this area, the fighting between the government forces and the Taliban, and they were running low on food. There was no electricity, no gas, so they were desperate situation. So many people would like to leave that area. And the feeling is that the total number of refugees will cross 1 million very soon.
Can you give us a sense of what it is the people are fleeing? Has the intensity of the combat picked up between government forces and the Taliban? What are they running from?
Of course, I mean, it was nearly now a week and a half that the government started their big assault in the Sawad Valley. When President Zardari, Pakistani President Zardari, was in Washington talking with President Obama about the AFPAC strategy, that is the time when this offensive started. And the Pakistan government and the Pakistan Prime Minister, they made it very clear they would like to flush out the Taliban fighters from Sawad Valley and the adjoining areas. So in 1 week, suddenly, there was no preparation for these people. They were not prepared for such assault, the civilians. So they were trapped in this whole battle. What the army and the military they have done is they have built huge they have sent reinforcement in those areas. They are sending it airborne troops, airborne units, especially in the northern part of the valley, which is a bit away from the main city, Mingora. So most of the people, they are in Mingora or around Mingora, and these are the people, they're getting hit by shells from the military artillery. There is air bombardment going on.
They're being hit by shells from the Pakistani government.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So they don't know. Also, the Taliban, they are coming, they are taking shelter within the civilian population. So it's very difficult even for the Pakistan army to pinpoint, to target and pinpointed attack, to carry out pinpointed attack on the Taliban fighters. So the civilians were caught. Pakistan government and the Pakistan military are saying that they have killed hundreds of Taliban fighters, but there is no way one can verify it independently. People who are fleeing, they're saying majority of them are civilian casualties.
That was Nazis Afros, Asia editor for our partners at the BBC. He was reporting to us on the continuing fighting in the Swat Valley in that interview conducted early this morning from London.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining whether states have the right to legislate the foods and restaurants that people choose. Is it a responsible way to make communities healthier, or does it violate freedom of choice? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Todd Zwillick. A war with no end. Maybe that's what the war on drugs has seemed like over the last 40 years since the Nixon administration coined the term. Now the Obama administration wants to pull away from it. So is there a new phrase in order, the blank on drugs?
My name's Kevin from Barnwell, South Carolina. I would call the war on drugs the war on everything except marijuana.
Call us with your new slogan at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. The legalization debate in a moment. First headlines with Femi Okay.
Thanks, John. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. In Pakistan, thousands of people are streaming into refugee camps seeking relief from the conflict in the northwest Swat Valley. The military has lifted the curfew to make it easier to leave. The United Nations is calling for a massive emergency injection of aid to improve conditions in the camps. In the Middle East, Pope Benedict is strongly condemning the Holocaust as a brutal extermination of Jews by a godless Nazi regime. The remarks come as he prepares to leave Israel. During his visit, the Pope faced criticism that he'd failed to sufficiently apologize for Nazi atrocities. The Pope once belonged to the Hitler Youth in his native Germany. Six major insurers have received preliminary approval to get billions of dollars from the TARP bailout fund. It's the end of a months-long quest by some in the sector for financial assistance. The Dutch photographer Hugh van Es, who captured some of the most enduring images of the Vietnam War, has died in Hong Kong at the age of 67. He's famed for a famous image of the fall of Saigon in 1975, showing an American helicopter leaving the city.
Oh, that's not the only picture, boy. He's got some amazing shots.
Many, many, many. You can see them online, actually. Just Google his name, Hugh Van Es, E-S, is how he ends his name. That is a look at your news for this morning from me. John.
Thank you, Femi. So we have a lot to talk about with our next guest. Glenn Greenwald is a salon columnist and author of the Cato Institute-funded study, Drug Decriminalization in Portugal, Lessons for Creating Fair and Successful Drug Policies. More on that in just a moment. But let's begin with Glenn Greenwald talking about the development that we're going to hear more details about later today. Barack Obama has decided now to go ahead with 20 military tribunals of detainees at Guantanamo after, you'll recall, suspending those same tribunals early on in the administration. There will be some modifications. We'll find out later this morning. Glenn Greenwald, you know a lot about this, particularly about the ground rules of these tribunals. Is it possible for the Obama administration to change them sufficiently to satisfy, say, the Supreme Court, which has been very critical of these military tribunals?
Well, whether it's possible to satisfy the Supreme Court is an open question. I suppose if you actually create the commissions to resemble as closely as possible our own civilian court system or the court's martial system that the military uses under the Code of Military Justice, a Supreme Court might say that it's constitutional to do that. But if you actually go back and look at what the bulk of the criticism was towards George Bush and the claims that he was abridging American freedoms and assaulting our core values, the argument was that creating military commissions in and of themselves is destructive to our core values because we have a judicial system that's several hundred years old, along with the military tribunal system, the courts martial system, that actually embodies and incorporates American legal principles, and to create a whole new system of justice for terrorists, to accuse terrorists, is a way of saying that we don't trust our own institutions, and I don't think you can tinker with the rules or modify them at all to address those concerns.
Well, certainly a lot of lawyers have already expressed disappointment that the Obama administration is going to proceed with even a modified military tribunal program. But the reason we asked you to get in touch with us, Glenn, from Rio de Janeiro, where you are this morning, is to talk about the war on drugs. The war on drugs has often been fought with military tactics, with law enforcement institutions, and even playful commercials on television.
Cowabunga!
The Ninja Turtles got involved at one point, but the war on drugs was coined by the Nixon administration quite a long time ago, and a major shift in how the U.S. deals with drug use may be in some of the rhetoric of a state senator, Barack Obama, here speaking at a debate during a campaign back in 2004.
The war on drugs has been a utter failure, and I think that we need to rethink and decriminalize our marijuana laws. But I'm not somebody who believes in legalization of marijuana. What I do believe is that we need to rethink how we are operating in the drug wars, and I think that currently we are not doing a good job.
Not for legalization, but for decriminalization, Barack Obama speaking back in 2004. And his new drug czar, Gil Kerlikowske, says he wants to get rid of the term war on drugs altogether. Glenn Greenwald, you actually support full decriminalization, legalization of drugs. How has that worked in Portugal, the place that you most recently studied?
Well, in that country, they actually had one of the worst drug problems, out of control, spiraling drug crises throughout the 1990s. And they found, as we are finding, that the more they try to criminalize, the more people they put into prison for drug usage and possession and trafficking, the worse the problem became. And so what they did was they convened a commission. They took it out of the realm of politics and appointed a commission of purely apolitical experts and asked them what would be the best policy that we could adopt to get a handle on our spiraling drug problem. And what that council said was that decriminalizing drugs would be the best way to be able to get reach the population and get a handle on drugs. And once that happened, the Portuguese Parliament in 2000 enacted that law, and then the president signed decriminalization in 2001. And 7 years later, what we find is that Portugal not only has stemmed the tide of its drug crisis, but manages its drug problems far more effectively than virtually every other country that embraces a harsh criminalization scheme, including the United States and other Western European countries.
Well, Glenn Greenwald, that's a nice little story, but I'm wondering if politically there's any conceivable way that an orderly process like that would take place in the United States. I mean, what was required for prohibition of alcohol was a gigantic national movement, and then the reversal of that, an equally gigantic national reversal. We don't see anything like that in the drug debate right now.
I'm not sure I agree with that. First of all, Portugal is a very socially conservative country. It's overwhelmingly Catholic, and they were initially very resistant to the idea of decriminalization. And what they did is what we are starting to do, which is to accept the premise that our current approach of criminalization has been a profound failure. And what you actually see is that there is movement in public opinion polls regarding, say, legalization and decriminalization of marijuana. You see leading political officials like Arnold Schwarzenegger openly entertain the idea that decriminalizing marijuana is necessary. When referenda go on state ballots to legalize medical marijuana, it passes continuously. And you even, I think most significantly of all, had a very important senator with lots of credibility, Jim Webb, the Democrat from Virginia, stand on the Senate floor last month and say that our criminal justice systems generally and our drug laws specifically are profound failures. And he introduced a bill that would create a commission like the one that led to decriminalization in Portugal that would be designed to take this out of the political and the moral and the emotional realm and simply ask as a matter of evidence and policy what is the optimal approach for dealing with the drug problem. And I think there are subtle trends that suggest that we are backing away from the war on drugs.
Right.
You just indicated yourself that Obama's drug czar said he no longer wants to even use the term a war on drugs.
But he does want to focus on treatment, and I'm wondering if that's the third way here, that you basically substitute treatment for the more controversial notion of legalization and kind of have it both ways. It remains illegal, but you increase the investment on treatment and nothing really changes legislatively. It seems like that's where we're going with Kerlikowske.
Well, I mean, in Portugal, they haven't legalized drugs. They decriminalized them. And what happens is exactly what you just described, which is if you get caught using drugs, the police still issue you a citation. But you can't be turned into a criminal. You don't go into the criminal court system. You appear before a commission of a psychologist and a drug counselor and usually a lawyer. And the idea is to offer the person who's using drugs, and especially addicts, treatment in order to go into treatment. And that's why they've been able to get their drug problem under control, because they've stopped treating drug users as criminals and stopped treating drugs as a criminal problem and started treating it
right
as a health problem. The problem is that if the government tells the citizens that we're going to turn you into criminals, they have a hard time reaching the citizens and a harder time funding treatment programs.
Lessons from Portugal from my guest Glenn Greenwald, Salon columnist and author of the Cato Institute-funded study Drug Decriminalization in Portugal. Could end up being the outline of the debate on the war on drugs. The administration begins to deal with this problem. Todd?
So, John, if the war on drugs does end, then what do we do? Maybe we need a new phrase, the what on drugs.
Hi, my name is Luke Carter. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. And as far as the war on drugs goes, there's really nothing changing with the Obama administration except the perception with the name. I think if they're going to call it anything, they might as well call it the prohibition on drugs, because that's how it has been in this country for a long time.
Jessica has emailed us. We need to go back and seriously fight the war on poverty if we want to win the war on drugs. We have to address the roots of why people turn to doing or selling drugs by improving their living environments. Tell us how we should deal with drugs in America at our website, thetakeaway.org. While you're there, you can also follow me around Washington by subscribing to my Twitter feed at thetakeaway.org. I promise you the sublime and the ridiculous and a little bit of the
no
serious
cost, no obligation. Tweet with Todd.
Tweet with Todd in Washington.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Tweet, tweet, tweet.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway,